afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time. And if you'd like to be on the program today, you can call me at our number for that. If you have questions about the Bible, the number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. And you can call if you have questions or even answers. Maybe you have a difference of opinion from the host and would like to express that difference of opinion here. We allow that here. And if you'd like to do so, give me a call at the same number, 1-800-438-5090. Our first call today is from Cordell, calling from Wichita, Kansas. Cordell, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
How you doing?
Good, thanks.
I listen to your program a lot, and I have to say I have a lot of respect for your positions and your opinions. Here lately, I've been listening to you, and I listen to you online, so I don't know exactly which dates or anything. But I've been hearing an opinion of yours as far as cremation, and it's okay to be cremated.
Yeah.
Well, as far as my understanding of the Bible, I have to disagree with you. And the reason being is I understand what you're saying as far as people being burned, you know, by the Inquisition and so on and so forth. Christians burn them. Burned at the stake, but the intent of the Bible, my understanding, says that man has come from the dust, and from the dust he shall return. Even in Genesis 2 and 7, it said God formed man from the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul.
Uh-huh.
Everything from that point on is speaking about, you know, whether it's from Isaiah, David, Solomon, you know, so on and so forth, is speaking about going back into the ground. And even in Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, 35, you know, in generally 35 through 54, is talking about the planting of a seed and how a seed develops and so on and so forth. And even Josephus, you know, and I know it's not biblical with Josephus, but he iterates the same thing as far as being planted in the ground and, you know, developing to a new body, you know. So as far as when the second coming is upon us, we'll be reaped into a new body. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I do agree with you that when Jesus comes back, we'll be raised in new bodies. But I'm not really sure how those particular considerations have a negative impact on the decision about cremation. It seems to me that when God says you go back to the dust, well, you do, whether you burn up or whether you just are decomposed by being eaten by worms. I mean, your body is decomposed. And what cremation does simply is speed the process up. It doesn't change it. It just reduces you to dust and ashes quicker.
Right. But like you said, the way I see it is when you say cremation, when you're burned, you're burned into ashes. It's not dust. I mean, ash is different than dust. I mean, as far as even with the biblical connotation coming from Paul, in First Corinthians 15, he's talking about being planted. You can't burn seed up and plant it and expect it to germinate and grow.
Your physical body is not a literal seed. It's a figure of speech when Paul talks about our bodies are planted in weakness and they're raised in power, and they're planted in dishonor and they're raised in glory and so forth. He is describing a burial there, but he's not mandating that bodies have to be buried. The point he's simply making is that, of course, most bodies are buried, and when they are buried, they're buried in weakness and so forth, but the resurrection will be of a different sort. The body that is buried, it does turn into dust. As you mentioned, some people are burned at the stake for their faith, or some are burned up in houses or in airplane crashes or whatever. Those things, I don't consider that those are exceptions to the case. I think that even those people could be said to have gone back to the elements. I mean, what is dust made of? I don't think that ashes are necessarily different than dust. At least a lot of the dust in my house comes from ashes from the fireplace. I think dust simply refers to small particles. And I don't think they have to be sand or, dirt or whatever. I'm not sure I don't really know what the limitations are and what we'd call dust, but I think anything that gathers in small granules, on the tabletop is dust, and that could be ashes or something else. It could be even pollen. But you know, I don't see it as really being that relevant a thought. But if somebody does, then they can certainly choose not to be cremated. But I don't think there's anything in the Bible that would, in fact, give us reason to condemn the act of cremation.
Okay. Like I said, it was just you've said it a few times, and it's something I want to respond to. It's
sure.
Not necessarily, you know, like I agree with a lot of things and a lot of positions that you take as far as nothing to argue about or anything, but it's something on my heart that I feel that I feel strongly about it personally, and I feel that, you know, if somebody is looking for direction or whatever, that a second thought can be given for an understanding other than just
Your phone is breaking. Your phone's breaking up pretty bad. I'm missing some of your syllables. So are you in a bad location?
I'm sorry. I don't know. Does this matter?
It's not much better. I got a feeling you're not going to be easily understood, just because you're cutting out so much. But I think
okay.
I got your point. I think I got your point, and I appreciate it. You're welcome to the position.
Right, and I appreciate the phone call. I'm going to send something else to you. I hope that you can review it, and it's nothing I really want to discuss over the air because it's not really important. But it's not the thing that you spoke about, and I just hope that you can answer it and give me your opinion, you know, via email or whatnot, and I appreciate your time.
Well, feel free to send it.
Yes, sir.
All right, God bless you.
Thank you. You too.
Bye now. Okay, that was Cordell from Wichita, Kansas. We've got Jeremiah from Corpus Christi, Texas next. And we have lines open also. If you'd like to join us, the number is 1-800-438-5090. Jeremiah, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, what's up, man? My call is, I guess, just kind of a question, but also just balanced comment on, I guess, a couple weeks ago, someone called in asking about, I talk about it quite a lot, but what happens to us when we die, and
yeah.
And you, I guess as a preface, I'm coming from someone that leans more towards soul sleep.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, my question is not to prove soul sleep or some kind of interim in heaven. That's not the point of my call. It's I wondered, because you mentioned 2 Corinthians chapter 5, where Paul talks about being absent from the body to present with the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, if in chapter 5, verse 4, for we who are in this tent groan, being burdened, not because we want to be unclothed, but further clothed, that mortality may be swallowed up by life, and then later on it talks about being absent from the body, present with the Lord. Do you think it might be more probable to be understood as to be absent from this body because he gives that caveat of not that I want to be unclothed, but further clothed with my heavenly body, as in the, I think he's talking about in the resurrection? You get where I'm going with this, or am I kind of jumping around?
Well, excuse me. I see what you're saying when Paul talks about not wanting to be unclothed. It sounds like he's saying he does not expect to be a disembodied spirit, but he's referring to perhaps being in a different body. He does say we have a house eternal in the heavens. And yet Paul very clearly talks about the resurrection elsewhere, which is not in heaven. The resurrection is not in heaven. The resurrection is when the bodies come out of the grave. So he's got something else in mind there. My understanding is a fairly typical one of evangelicals in general, that when you die, you are unclothed. That is, you are disembodied for a while. And though Paul says we will be, you know, absent from the body when we die, yet our ultimate goal is not to be permanently absent from the body or to be unclothed. Our ultimate goal is to be housed in a better body than this. However, that awaits the resurrection, I think. And so I think that what Paul is saying is we have a present body that is a tent, a temporary dwelling place. And it's a tent in which we have trials. We groan in this tent. We would like to be delivered from it. Our ultimate goal, though, is not to be disembodied. Our ultimate goal is not to be unclothed. Our ultimate goal is to have a resurrected body. a more permanent and superior body.
Right.
But that being said, he still, I think, says that we will have a time after death where we're absent from the body and present with the Lord. But of course, when the Lord comes, he's going to bring us with him and raise our bodies. At least that's how I understand the teaching of Scripture on that. I've never had very much emotional stake in the question. So, I mean,
if
there's a different way of looking at it, it's okay with me. Yeah.
Right, okay. I assume you've been around long enough and seen enough different ideas to know that passage to be absent from the body is present with the Lord, or even elsewhere, he said, I desire to depart and be with Christ. That is very easily understood from someone that thinks the Scripture teaches that when you die, you're unconscious, and the next thing you know, you see Christ in paradise. I would assume that you understand that when.
Well, yeah, I've had a number of people who believe in soul sleep, who have said that when he talks about being present with the Lord and absent with the body, he's talking about the resurrection, right?
Right, and that's what I thought. It seems to me a case of if he says, not that I desire to be unclothed, but to be further clothed. I think I'm not making a dogmatic statement, but I think part of what he's referring to is in contrast to the culture of the time that the Corinthians would have been not accustomed, but familiar with the whole Platonic view of. Humans, like in Mars Hill, when he talks about the resurrection, they were like, whatever, you're stupid, because they desired to be disembodied spirits from their, they saw the body
right.
as evil.
Right, exactly.
And then later on, I think it ends in verse 12 of that chapter 5 of 2 Corinthians, he goes into where we shall all appear before the judgment seat of Christ. So I guess my point is that what it seems to me is Paul's entire thought, starting back in verse 14 of chapter 4, is the resurrection the entire time, and that to place the interim of heaven in when he says to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord, that it's kind of shoehorning into the flow of his thought this interim in heaven when it seems like
it is just it is actually but even if we take it that way, that's not really unlike Paul, is it? I mean, doesn't Paul frequently
wander
around and have parenthetical statements and things?
That's
not uncommon. I do think you're right, that Paul's hope is not the hope of heaven, but the hope of resurrection. And I think everywhere in Scripture, the Christian hope is to be made like Christ in the resurrection.
But
the question of whether there's an interim between the time we die and the time that we actually realize that hope of resurrection, and whether in that interim, after we die, we go to heaven and await the resurrection, is
right.
not something that would cancel out that at all. That would simply be, if it is in Paul's thinking, and I think it is. I could be wrong, but I think it is in Paul's thinking. But if it is in his thinking, it doesn't seem, out of character for Paul to mention.
We're looking
forward to being resurrected with Christ. However, of course, we realize that we will first, after dying, be absent from the body. See, in the resurrection, we're not absent from the body. In the resurrection, we're in a body.
Right. Mortality has been put on.
Yeah.
Mortality is put on immortality. Right.
Right. So being absent from the body, I mean, you're suggesting maybe he just means absent from this present body.
This body. And the reason I'm, I guess, harping on that so much is because he seems to make it a point to say, now, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying I want to be unclothed, I want to but be further clothed,
Yeah.
And I could be making a mountain out of a molehill, but like you said, I'm not emotionally attached to it either. If it turns out I get to be with Jesus as soon as I die, then, until
I can see.
That's cool too, man, I don't care. But it seems to me that at least, and that's why I said I wasn't trying to disprove or prove soul sleeper or interim in heaven, was just that I don't think this verse can be, as it's traditionally always used, I don't think it really can be employed to do what we usually traditionally employ to do.
Do you believe that Paul had a concept of the human consciousness or human soul or whatever being capable of being separated from the body and being not in the body?
I guess this is where my cards came out. I'm starting to think no. I'm starting to think he wasn't a dualist. But
Yeah, the reason I ask is because in the same book, 2 Corinthians, in chapter 12, when he talks about a man he knew in Christ who was caught in the third heaven, twice he says he didn't know whether this happened in the body or out of the body.
Yeah, man. I was just wondering if you were going to bring that one up. But I think that one is also misconstrued. I'm not saying it's clear the way, but I do not think it's as clear as we would like it to be that what he's referring to is the experience this man had, whether it's Paul or some other guy. I don't know.
Uh-huh.
But I think if you read the King James especially seems to make it very clear that it's not referring to the experience this man had, whether or not the experience was out of his body or in his body. He didn't know that God knows, but it was how he knew this man, whether in the body or out of the body. What it says is, I knew a man in Christ 14 years ago.
Yeah.
Whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows how he was caught up to the third heaven. And it's just, I knew such a man. Whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows. He's just caught up to paradise and blah, blah. It doesn't. It seems to me that it could be just as easily referring to how he knew this man. And not
so,
necessarily.
Well, I'll grant you that the wording could be taken that way, but what would that mean? I don't understand what the statement would be. I knew a man. I don't know if I knew him in the body or out of the body.
Well,
I mean, what's
I
that referring
if we,
to?
If we strip away the traditional, not traditional, but long time accepted, well, Paul's talking about himself. He says he's being humble, and he says he's talking about someone else, but he's talking about himself. I think if we don't bring that to the table, I think it's just as I guess maybe you could say nebulous as Paul being in with the church in spirit when they judged this man earlier.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I don't know. I mean.
Okay. Well, to me, I mean, maybe there's some other ways to look at it. I consider that taking the idea that Paul believed there's an inner man and an outer man. And by the way, there's a lot of noise right there. I'm going to put you on hold so I don't have to listen to all that screeching, whatever that is. When Paul talks about there being an inner man and an outer man, as he does, for example, in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, where he says our inner man, he says my outer man is being destroyed. He means physically, you know, facing death. But he says the outer man is being destroyed, but the inner man is being renewed day by day. And that being so means to me, it sounds like Paul's saying, okay, there's two aspects of my existence. There's the physical, and then there's this other aspect, which I personally think would be identified with what we usually call the soul or the spirit. And he says, that's the inner man. And I believe that inner man is who Paul considers himself really to be, which is why he doesn't care. He says he doesn't care if his outer man is destroyed. The inner man is safe. The inner man is secure. The inner man is being renewed. And that being so, it makes it sound like Paul is identifying himself with his own inner man, not with his outer man so much. And so that it hardly matters to him how the outer man is, you know, fares. And then, immediately after that, in chapter 5, he talks about being absent from the body. I guess Paul doesn't say so, but it seems to me that the outer man he's referring to in chapter 4 is the same as the body he's referring to in chapter 5. And therefore, what is absent or present in the body is the inner man, or the soul. Now, this may not be the right way of looking at things, but I can't think of a way that the words would more naturally be understood. And if there is a more natural way, I'm certainly always open to hearing it. I have heard people, you know, dispute that Paul's words here teach a conscious existence of the soul after death. And say, no, he believed that you're sleeping after death and you just are resurrected with the Lord. Well, maybe so, but his words don't sound that way to me. And I, you know, no one has to go along with what things sound like to me, but I do. And so that would be my take on all that.
Well, as far as the inner man and the outer man, other people talking about, well, whatever they said, I don't know. it seems just as easy to me to take them to be, like, because I'm not saying I don't believe in spirits. I'm not a Sadducee. like, anyway, inner man and outer man, it could just as easily refer to the way God looks at us. You know, like, God, man sees the outside. God sees what's in the heart. The outer
okay.
man is who the rest of the world sees, but the inner man is the part that God sees, our heart.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
You know what I mean? But
sure.
I don't know. I guess my only point was that's why I made it a point to say I wasn't trying to disprove or prove soul sleep or interim or dualism or monism or whatever, but just that I think these things can easily be understood other ways. And anyway.
Okay. Okay. Well, I appreciate you bringing that up.
Yeah, man, it was cool talking with you, and I'm glad. I was kind of disappointed that I had to call to disagree with you, because man, you taught me a lot, and I really
appreciate it. No problem. That's all right.
Later, man. Have a
God bless you, Jeremiah. Thanks for calling. Okay, let's talk to John from Ann Arbor, Michigan. John, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I haven't called in a long time, but I'm still out there listening.
Ah.
I've got, you might know me from Washington or Thunder Bay, so I don't know.
Yes, hi.
So
this is Jonathan, you mean?
Yes,
gotcha. I recognized your voice, yes. It took a while because I didn't associate you with Ann Arbor.
Yeah. So I was looking at Daniel 9, and a lot of times we look at the timing of the 490 years, but I was actually looking at the timing before that. We have Jeremiah 25, where God predicts there'll be 70 years in captivity. And I was trying to make, I always assumed that fit right on the beginning of the 490 years, and that Daniel was receiving that prophecy right when the 7 years were about to be complete. But I can't make the years work out, because it looks like the deportation started 597 B.C., 587, and it looks like Babylon, when I went back to Jeremiah, it actually says that the Jews would serve the king of Babylon 7 years. So he fell, Babylon fell in 540, and maybe there was a gap after the Persians took over before that decree was made? That
It gets confusing to know what those 70 years were, because there were three deportations, or three phases of the deportation, of course, in 605 B.C. when Daniel and his friends were taken away. That was the beginning. Nebuchadnezzar came and captured whoever he wanted to and took them away to Babylon. In a sense, even though most of the Jews were left in Judah at that time, they were subject to Babylon in the sense that Babylon could just come and do what they wanted with them. At that point, the Babylonians did not choose to deport the whole population, but they did deport.
That would make 65 years, actually, which is close.
Well, if you go from 605 B.C. to 586, 538 B.C. when Cyrus did his decree, that's like 67 years or something, isn't it? I mean, I'm not doing the math in front of me, and I don't do math well in my head, but it seems like that comes mighty close to 70 years. But there are several different starting points. Some people start it at 586 B.C., and they don't... Jonathan, it looks like you got cut off. I don't know why. I didn't touch anything. So, anyway, but you're still listening, I hope. I think if you start at 586 B.C. when Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the temple, then you go forward 70 years in time, you come to 516 B.C., and that is the year that the exiles who had returned from Babylon completed the temple in rebuilding it. So the temple was burned down in 586, and it was completed and restored in 516. To me, that's an exact 70 years. That could be, the 70 years of captivity, even though many of the Jews had come back earlier with Zerubbabel. They were still pretty much, in their same condition they had been in 586, in a way, until the temple was restored. So the temple was, in fact, was waste for 70 years. And there are, I have seen, I think, three or four different calculations from different starting points and different ending points making out the 70 years. But if you take, you know, the latest point of deportation, which is 586 B.C., and the earliest point of restoration, which would be Cyrus's decree in 538 B.C., then you only really have, what, 40 years of, or something like that, 40-something. And it doesn't come to 70. But different scholars have pointed out different ways in which that 70 can be calculated. All of them seem very valid. But to me, one of the most important ones would appear to be the time from the temple being destroyed to the time of the temple being rebuilt. And that was exactly 70 years, as I recall. So, also, like I said, if you start measuring from 605 B.C., then you're going to come to like 535 B.C., which is just within 3 years or so of Cyrus's decree. So it's almost exactly 70 years there. It's 67 years or something. And one could argue that the 70 is a round number, too. But I don't think it has to be, because there are a number of ways in which it can be made out to be exactly 70. Looks like we've got John back on here. John, sorry, we got cut off. You there?
Yeah, that was my fault. My cell phone didn't work in my basement.
Okay, now your voice is quite faint.
Oh, well, it's a different phone.
It's better now. Okay, gotcha.
Okay, I'll try to talk louder. I just had, okay, the other point was Daniel 9:27.
Uh-huh.
And this came up on a show maybe 3 weeks ago, but that strange language in the, most of the translations about the wing of abominations.
Yeah.
I looked up the Hebrew there for wing, and it just looks like the generic word for wing. It's sometimes used for a garment that would flap loose. And I'm, have you made any sense of what a, how an abomination can have a wing?
No, I don't really know. It actually says, in the New King James, it says, on the wing of abominations shall be one who makes desolate. Now, it's obviously very poetic language.
Uh-huh.
We could say that a series of abominations come flying in, as it were,
okay,
like a bird of prey. You know, it could be a figure of speech. And upon the wing of these abominations, there's one particular abomination that comes in that leads to the desolation of the city. I've always kind of seen it that way, but I can't really tell you it means that, because this expression is, I believe, unique in Scripture, and it's in poetry. And I've never really been good at understanding English poetry, much less Hebrew poetry. Actually, I probably understand Hebrew poetry better than English poetry, but there's much I don't understand. So I can't really say why such an image would be used. But as you know, you know very well that some translations like the NIV try to make it out to be a wing of the temple. But I don't really see that as a likely and certainly not a necessary way of applying the expression.
So you remember you had a listener recommend the Orthodox Study Bible that had an Old Testament based on the Septuagint?
Yeah, I remember someone mentioning that, yeah.
I couldn't help but get that, and it's interesting that this verse, it does have quite a different reading, which I thought I'd read to you, and maybe you could,
okay.
I can't quite make sense of it, but it says, "My sacrifice and drink offering will be taken away, and there shall be in the temple the abomination of desolations, and to the end of the time, an end to the desolation shall be appointed."
Yeah, interesting. So they've actually changed the word wing altogether into the word temple.
No, not temple.
Oh, yeah, it looks like it.
"And there shall be in the temple the abomination of desolations."
Yeah, see, it says, on the wing of abominations shall be one that makes desolate.
Yeah.
Obviously, the wording of that verse is extremely precarious. And different translators have done widely different things with it.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming the Hebrew is quite obscure.
Okay, I guess we've gone about as far as we can with that one.
Certainly, with my level of expertise, we can't go much further.
Yeah. Okay, thanks a lot, Steve.
Okay, John, good to hear from you again. God bless you.
God bless you.
Bye now. All right, let's talk to Dave from Mukwonago, Wisconsin. Did I say it right this time, Dave?
I'm here. You there?
Yeah. Did I say Mukwonago correctly?
No.
Not quite. Say it for me then.
Mukwonago.
Mukwonago. That's right. Like I want to go. Okay.
Yeah,
gotcha. Mukwonago.
It's an old Indian name. Lots of those around here in Wisconsin.
Okay. Well, you've told me before, but it's been a long time, so I forgot where.
Yeah,
I put the emphasis on the wrong syllable.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm out here in Wisconsin. I catch all your broadcasts, you know, over the Internet and the iPod and such. And I really enjoy the show and find it a really good resource. And your stuff on the website, really thought-provoking, quite refreshing, I might say.
Thank you.
The newer replacements that you're putting out for the School of the Bible and all those courses and such,
uh-huh.
Do you have a way to tell which ones are new compared to the old content?
Yeah, the new ones don't have the tape hiss. You don't hear the in the background for all of it. Yeah. Also, the new ones, the tape doesn't run out before the lecture.
I see.
And you don't lose a minute or so at the halfway point through as the tape turns itself over. So, in other words, the new lectures are digitally recorded, and the old ones were on cassette tape. But even then, sometimes the quality of the tapes might be good enough that you might not have recognized the difference. But for the most part, what we've done, what's new up there are the books of the Pentateuch, the Gospel of John, the Gospel of Mark. I'm not sure which ones are all up there. We recorded a bunch of new ones that have not yet been loaded, and that's because I'm doing some editing, and that takes forever. But hopefully not literally forever, but eventually I'll have them all up there. But I think on some of them it actually says new by them. Maybe not.
Okay, I'll have to look a little closer. My question today is I looked up all the verses for Mary Magdalene.
Yeah.
Magdalene. And I was wondering if you could tell me where the tradition came or how it came into being, you know, that who she was, and there's no information there other than she was delivered of seven.
Right. All we know about her background is what we read in Luke 8:2. Yeah, where it says certain women who had been healed of evil spirits and infirmities, Mary called Magdalene, out of whom had come seven demons. We don't know on what occasion that happened or not. Now, of course, you may be aware of the Catholic tradition that she was a prostitute or something like that. But there's no indication of that in Scripture. It would appear that the suggestion that Mary Magdalene was a prostitute before she followed Jesus comes from a sermon where I forget which pope it was, a pope was giving a sermon, and he mentioned Mary having been a prostitute, but he did not defend the view from anywhere. But after that, it became sort of a tradition among the Catholics, as she was. But the apparent reason for saying so is that the first mention of her in Luke is in chapter 8, verse 2. And it comes immediately after chapter 7, which tells the story about the sinful woman who washed Jesus' feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair in the house of Simon, the Pharisee. And so that story brings us to the end of chapter 7. And then right near the beginning of chapter 8, we have a mention of Mary Magdalene. But that doesn't identify her with that woman.
Right.
And other women are mentioned in Luke 8:3, Joanna, the wife of Chuza, Herod's servant, a steward, Susanna, and many others. So, yeah, there's no real reason to identify Mary with the woman, the sinful woman of the previous chapter.
Yeah, I was just curious. And I know that a lot of, I guess you'd call them scholars or whatever. They seem to be pretty fascinated with Mary the Magdalene, and they come up with some really, really wild ideas about her being, you know, the wife of Christ and all kinds of silly things.
Yeah, the idea that Mary was the wife of Christ was popularized by the Da Vinci Code. Yeah.
Right, Mary the Magdalene.
Mary Magdalene, right. The Da Vinci Code claimed that she was the wife of Christ and claimed that that was based on one of the Gnostic Gospels, the Gospel of Philip. But there's nothing in the Gospel of Philip that says she was the wife of Christ. There was a line in that Gnostic Gospel, which, by the way, is a forgery. It's not a real gospel. But it said something that...
Nag Hammadi text?
Yeah, it was found among the Nag Hammadi library. But the Gospel of Philip says something like that Jesus loved Mary Magdalene more than all the other disciples and frequently kissed her. Well, that's not even clear what that means, because people, you know, we think of kissing as something done between a man and woman when they're romantic. But in the Middle
Correct.
East, people kiss all the time as an affectionate greeting or whatever. So it's not really at all clear what it's saying, but it certainly doesn't say they were married. And it's from that passage alone that it is suggested that she was his wife. And it's not even in a book that carries any authority or any weight.
Right. Well, I guess that's enough to write a book, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm out here listening, so keep up the good work, and I really appreciate your ministry.
Dave, I appreciate your call.
All right, bye-bye.
Thanks for calling. Bye now. You're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg, and you can reach me here at this number, 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. I'll be right back.
Are you aware of the wide variety of teachings available without charge at the Narrow Path website? In several hundred lectures, Steve Gregg covers every book of the Bible individually and gives separate teachings on approximately 300 important biblical topics. In over 30 years of teaching the Bible and over 15 years directing a Bible-based discipleship school, there are few biblical subjects that Steve has not had occasion to think through and to address. As you listen to these lectures, we think you'll be struck by and appreciate the fair-minded objectivity, the responsible research, and the deep meditation exhibited in each presentation. Often Steve's views do not reflect the majority viewpoint of modern evangelicalism. This divergence does not arise from any interest in being controversial, but from a desire to faithfully handle the Word of God, even at the price of taking unpopular positions. Verse-by-verse commentary on the majority of the books of the Bible, as well as hundreds of other stimulating lectures, can be downloaded in MP3 format without charge from our website, www.thenarrowpath.com. There's no charge for anything at our website. Visit us there and you'll be amazed at all you've been missing. That web address again is www.thenarrowpath.com.
All right, and we're back. You're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg, and that announcement was just to acquaint you with the fact that there are very many resources for free at our website, thenarrowpath.com. Most of the resources are audio files, MP3 files of lectures on hundreds of biblical topics, as well as verse-by-verse lectures through the Bible. Check that out. They're free. You can just download them or listen to them on your computer, thenarrowpath.com. Let's talk next to Marty from Las Vegas, Nevada. Marty, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. My question today is about if you could explain the correlation between John the Baptist and the spirit of Elijah.
Well, that's a good point. Malachi chapter 4 said that God would send Elijah before the coming of the great and terrible day of the Lord. Now, the great and terrible day of the Lord is apparently the destruction of Jerusalem. And, the Old Testament prophets, many of them, most of them, predicted that Jerusalem would someday be destroyed, and that the Old Covenant, because of the unfaithfulness of its participants, would be replaced with a new covenant. You find this in Jeremiah, you find it in Isaiah, you find it in, I find it in almost all the prophets. In fact, Jesus said in Luke chapter 21, in verse 20 and following, that when the armies would surround Jerusalem, which they did in AD 70, he said that Jerusalem would be destroyed. It says, so that all things that are written may be fulfilled. So Jesus indicated that all the old prophets talked about things that would be fulfilled in the destruction of Jerusalem. As I read the prophets many times, I find references to the fact that the old system is going to be, because of its corruption, destroyed and replaced with a new system. Well, that transition was to be marked by warnings. Before the old covenant would fall completely, God was going to send warning. And Malachi says, both in Malachi chapter 3 and 4, that he would send Elijah. Well, Malachi 3 just says, I'll send my messenger before your face. He doesn't call him Elijah, but in Malachi 4:5, he calls him Elijah. And he says he'll come before the great and terrible day of the Lord, which Jesus said, if you can receive it, John is Elijah who is to come. So the terrible day of the Lord was about to come when Jesus was here and when John the Baptist were here. It came in that next within that generation. But John came in the spirit and power of Elijah. We're told that in Luke chapter 1, where the angel is speaking to his father, Zechariah, and said, your son will come in the spirit and the power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the fathers to their children and the foolish to the disobedient to the obedience of the just. And so it would appear what the angel is saying to Zechariah is that the prophecy of Malachi would be fulfilled not by the coming of the actual man, Elijah, from the past, but by another man who comes as the spiritual fulfillment. He comes in the spirit of Elijah, and that would be John the Baptist. Now, when John began baptizing in John chapter 1, we're told that the Pharisees asked him, are you the Messiah? And he said, no. And they said, are you Elijah? And he said, no, which may throw us off a little bit because John said, I am not Elijah. But when Jesus was talking to his disciples in Matthew 11, he said, if you can receive it, John is Elijah who is to come. And so how is that? John said he's not Elijah. And Jesus said, if you can receive it, he is. I believe that John was answering their question as he knew they meant it. They wondered if he was Elijah, the Tishbite, the man who had come in the days of Ahab and Jezebel and had stopped the rain for 3.5 years and so forth. John was not that man. He was another man. He was John, not Elijah. But Jesus said, if you can receive it, he's Elijah. And I think what he means by that is the prophecy of Elijah who is to come is to be fulfilled spiritually, not literally. And, of course, the natural man cannot receive the things of the Spirit of God. They're spiritually discerned. So Jesus wasn't sure if his disciples were spiritual enough to receive it. But if they could, they could recognize that this prophecy about Elijah had already been fulfilled in John the Baptist because he came in the spirit and power of Elijah. Now, what does it mean that he came in the spirit of Elijah? It's hard to say only because the word spirit is used in so many different ways in the Bible. Sometimes it speaks of a man's human spirit. Sometimes it speaks of an angel or a demonic spirit or even of God as a spirit. And sometimes it's used even more generically, like a spirit of fear or, you know, a spirit of harlotry or something like that, which is not necessarily referring to a demon, but rather a mood or an attitude of fear. So to say he came in the spirit of Elijah is not 100% clear what that even does mean, except that he was the spiritual fulfillment of the prediction that Elijah would come. It may simply mean he came in the spiritual authority and power of Elijah. But to say that it means that specifically would be a little speculative because it's not entirely clear what it means to come in the spirit of Elijah. But I believe that, clear or not, the point that Jesus makes from it later on is that John is the spiritual fulfillment of the prophecy in Malachi.
I see. Well, doesn't at some point, I believe it's in Matthew, doesn't he say that he did come, but some did not recognize him?
Yeah, he mentions
that,
John.
That's open to translation.
Well, no, that is, I think, in Matthew chapter 11. See, there's twice in Matthew that Jesus speaks about John as Elijah. One of them is Matthew 11, the other is Matthew 17. Let me see. I'll turn to Matthew 11 and see if that's the one. He says, assuredly I say to you, verse 11, Matthew 11:11, among those born of women there is not arisen one greater than John the Baptist, but he who is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he. And from the days of John the Baptist till now, the kingdom of heaven suffers violence, and the violent take it by force. For all the prophets and the law prophesied until John, and if you are willing to receive it, he is Elijah who is to come. Okay, I think the passage you're thinking of may be the other time he mentions it, which is in chapter 17 of Matthew. And he said, in verse 12, he said to his disciples, but I say to you that Elijah has already come, and they did not know him. That's what you're referring to. But they did to him whatever they wished. Likewise, the Son of Man shall also be suffering at their hands. It says, and the disciples understood that he spoke to them of John the Baptist. Yeah, so Jesus mentioned that Elijah had, in fact, come in the person of John the Baptist, but he was not recognized as having that significance. They didn't see him as the fulfillment of Malachi. The Jews did not.
Well, I think probably you're right. That's because it was a spiritual thing, and it has to be spiritually discerned. So,
right. See,
well, that's
it's
very helpful. Thank you.
All right, Marty. Thanks for your call. Good
Thank
talk
you.
To you. Yeah. Yeah. This statement of Jesus actually does bring something out of importance, and that is that we humans, we Westerners especially, but apparently even the Jews, who are not what we call Westerners at all, they're Middle Easterners, but we tend to take things very literally. And yet Jesus and the apostles seem to take a number of passages in the Old Testament spiritually. And there, with some of those passages, there remains a conflict between certain Christian camps about whether they're to be taken literally or spiritually. In general, the dispensational camp feels that we should take all the prophecies literally, although they don't do that themselves, but they consider that that is nonetheless the right thing for people to do. Whereas the Reformed camp tends to recognize that there are things in the Old Testament that were not intended to be understood literally. They were to be understood spiritually. And that leads to a different set of expectations sometimes, especially in prophecies in the Old Testament that talk about God's future dealings and exaltation of Jerusalem or Zion or Israel or whatever. Those who take Israel to be natural Israel and natural Jerusalem and natural Zion obviously have one set of expectations. Those who recognize a spiritual fulfillment, a spiritual Jerusalem and spiritual Zion, a spiritual Israel, would tend to see that those prophecies as having a different kind of fulfillment. But the point I would make from this, from what Marty brought up, is that the passage in Malachi about John the Baptist coming is taken quite literally by dispensationalists and by maybe some who don't regard themselves dispensationalists. They believe that Elijah, the man from the days of Ahab and Jezebel, is going to come back again in the end times. Some people think when they talk about the two witnesses in Revelation 11 that one of them will be Elijah, because they think he has to come back according to Malachi. But that's not necessarily what Jesus taught. Jesus seemed to say that if you're able to receive it, John is the fulfillment of that prophecy. Well, I am able to receive it, so I don't look for another fulfillment of the prophecy. For those who aren't able to receive it, then I guess you'll have to look for another fulfillment, but you might be mistaken, because Jesus apparently was encouraging us to see John as the fulfillment of it. And if he is, then there's not any obvious reason why we should look for a secondary fulfillment of Malachi if it's already been fulfilled, as Jesus said. Well, you're listening to The Narrow Path, and it's obvious that the view I have on some of these issues are different, perhaps, than the views of many that you'll hear on the radio or elsewhere. And if that's true and you want to call to balance comment or to disagree, you're welcome to do so. We have about 4 minutes left, and our lines have just cleared. We have no calls waiting. You could get right through if you want to call right now, 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. And while I wait your call, I will say something about our finances, only because I think a follow-up is appropriate after the things I shared at the end of the year. I mentioned in December that we our expenses were much higher than the income, and therefore we might have to drop some radio stations that are carry us now, because, as you may know, we buy the time from the radio stations. There's nobody who, if you send contributions, nobody gets any money from it except the radio stations and our long-distance carrier that covers the 800 number. And so we pay for the radio time, but it's expensive, and we don't have any income source except listeners. So I did mention in December that we might have to drop some stations. Sadly, we did. We dropped one station, a significant one, a large one, in the Sacramento, California area, and it's sad because we received a lot of calls from them and even letters and even some donations, but just not enough. But if you're listening to me today on the radio, the station that you're listening to, we have been able to continue on. But our continuation is month by month, and it's often very tenuous. So we just want you to know that we're glad that you're able to listen to us today in January, but there's no there's nothing nailed down for the rest of the year or anything like that. We still depend on listener contributions to continue on the air. If you want to contribute, you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. That's a new address. We used to have a Santa Cruz address. We've moved. The address is now P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. And you can find that address at our website, of course, thenarrowpath.com. Let's talk next to Rick from Portland, Oregon. Rick, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi. I have a question on John 21. The two different kinds of words used for love in at the end of that chapter, is there a corresponding words like that in the Aramaic?
That's
and if not, why do you think John inserted them like that?
That's a really good question, because lots of times preachers make an issue of the fact that Jesus used two different Greek words for love at the end of John when he said to Peter, "Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me?" The first two times in the Greek of John, it is, "Do you agape me?" And Peter's answer was, "I phileo you," a different Greek word for love. And then Jesus said, "Do you agape me?" And he said again, "I phileo you." So Jesus changed the question, said, "Do you phileo me?" And Peter said, "I phileo you." So there are different words in the Greek, but your question is, are there different words in the Aramaic, which is the actual language Jesus was speaking? And I can't really say that I know. I don't know if anyone knows the exact Aramaic words Jesus was using, but I'm sure the Aramaic language does have, you know, different nuanced words, just like every language does. I mean, a word like phileo could be, you know, could render an English word like fondness or something like that. Whereas agape could render a word like sacrificial love or selfless love. And I'm sure that for these different nuances of the whole category of love, the Aramaic has its various words as well, though we don't necessarily know which Aramaic words Jesus used. I think that John was no doubt reflecting in the different Greek words he used an actual difference in the Aramaic words that were used in the conversation between Jesus and Peter. But I don't know what those Aramaic words were. The alternative would be that the same word for love in Aramaic was used all the time, and John, understanding what Jesus was getting at, gave the Greek words that give the nuances of what was really being implied rather than a difference that was in the Aramaic words. I don't know if anyone knows the answer to that. I wish I did, Rick. I've wondered that myself. And so I'm sorry I can't help you any more than I can help myself on that one. I'd like to know that myself. But
thank you very much.
I appreciate your call. God bless you, brother.
Bye-bye.
Bye. You've been listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we do this Monday through Friday from 2 o'clock to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time. And as I said a moment ago, our presence on the radio depends very much on whether listeners like yourself want us to be there enough to help, you know, pay the radio bills. We just don't have a printing press for printing money, and we don't have any sponsors. We don't sell anything. We don't have any commercial breaks. If you notice, we do take a break sometimes, but it doesn't sell anything. It's just something about free stuff at the website. So if you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593, or just go to our website. You can get our address there, or you can donate from there, or you can just go and take stuff and don't donate at all. Just take stuff from us. The website is thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. I hope you'll tune in again tomorrow, and we'll continue our discussion. God bless you.